town, what things might look like, you know, if we tore apart the helix. And I, tried to select images that had to do with that process. And that process, to me, is both very concrete, like inheritance, things that you inherit. But it's also got a lot to do with luck and chance. And that's something I'm really interested in, is chance and luck. And I think so a lot of the icons that I selected for the sculpture, like dice, had to do with that. And, you know, for those of you that don't know my work, I really just find things. I don't really make anything. I prefer to find objects that I really like, both from nature and from industry, and put them together. You know, when I started working with found objects or objects that were already in existence, one of my big reasons for doing that was because I didn't think I could do any better. In other words, the things from nature, like these, to me are amazing and beautiful. And, you know, why kind of waste my time trying to make things like that when they already existed? And so the whole idea of appropriation is something I really like a lot. And, you know, it doesn't matter to me that I manufactured something. What matters is that I made something. The actual manufacturing of objects, it's a wonderful thing, but it's not something I'm really interested in. It's both liberating and it also has its limitations. You know, for example, like I think of this, I consider myself a sculptor because I'm really interested in 3D. However, you know, this is like a big line drawing also. And when you draw, the advantage is, you know, you have a pencil or whatever, and you can make a mark. But for me, so in my studio, which is large, I basically have a library of objects, a library of shapes. So if I need this particular mark or this particular kind of line, I have to go and get it. So I spend a lot of time collecting. I would say about once a year I go to the equator, to different places, because on the equator is where nature ranks supreme and is huge. And I do collect pods, things from nature, things that fall off of trees also there. But in my desire to search out the most robust, biggest objects, the things that I felt were really the best, I had to go to the equator, because there things really grow very rapidly. So I go there, I collect a lot of objects, and then, you know, I spend plenty of time going to flea markets, trying to find farmers who are clearing out their barns. And also I have a pretty big network of people, friends, acquaintances, who know what I'm up to, who deliver to me. Great stuff. So, and even while I've been here, I got a keyboard, piano, piano keys, I got some fishing bobbers, etc. You know, so usually when I meet people or they understand what I'm up to, that also helps a lot to get objects. So, you know, I would say I spend, a lot of time in search of things that I like. And, you know, basically my criteria is intuition. Like, what do I like? And I really believe that everybody has the same exact skill set. I'm really no different than anybody else. If you lay down a blanket and you put 30 objects on it, everybody's going to be attracted to a certain format, a certain kind of paradigm of, you know, what do you love? And I think, you know, part of the show, both the piece out there, which is called Melody Maker, and this one, Twisted Ladder, embrace the things that I like. And, you know, I am really just an observer, not unlike everybody else sitting here. And I really enjoy that role of observation, of looking for the things that I really like and trying to make sense of things that I really don't understand. And that's kind of my reason for making art, is to try to understand what I don't understand. And therefore, you know, the reason I built this piece, I don't know if I understand any better now. My ideas about molecular structure, DNA, helixes and stuff like that, but it sure felt good to do it. And it was very cathartic. The piece that's out there, I made in 2013, and I have already shown that. And it's a little, the way it gets installed is a little bit different. And people are generally somewhat interested in the process, and the process is this. I build a piece in my studio. It's really exciting. I don't really know what I'm doing. I have some vague ideas of what I'm doing. And I pretty much jump in and just, you know, dive right in and start doing it. And through process of elimination, I more or less figure out what's going to work for me. Once I make the piece, I take an image of it. The sculpture comes down into crates. And then when I have a show, the image gets projected on the wall. You go into the crate and just start pinning them up exactly the way they were in my studio. And then once the show is over, if the piece gets sold, it comes down again and it goes up wherever its final home or resting place is. For this particular piece, my studio was full. All my walls were full. So I laid out a bunch of paper on the floor and I built the piece on the floor. And I realized that I was missing a lot of elements, like gravity. And, you know, gravity is a big time force. And I realized with this thing laying on the ground that everything was going to change when I brought it up here. So for this piece, I didn't take any images of it to reproduce it on the wall because I knew I couldn't. So this is about, I think, 160 linear feet. These all are drilled pods, and they're strung on this wire. Anyway, so this was more like being in my studio. That sculpture out there was, for me, it would just be rote to put it up again, mindless activity. But for this particular sculpture, I felt like I was in my studio. I had a pretty good idea of what I wanted to do and what I wanted to say, and I just came here and executed since Monday night, and I finished Thursday, and I'm totally fried. But it felt good, and you know, the saddest thing is I'm leaving and I'm not going to see it again. So, you know, that's the bad side of it. The good side is I had a really great time building it, and challenging, fun.
So will it be photographed so that you, and then put away in boxes so you can reconstruct it somewhere else?
No, I don't think so, because it's too long, and there's no projection system, that no lens that can really accurately capture whatever this is, 45 feet or something like that. It just isn't going to work out. And I think the next place it's going to go is I have a show at the Philadelphia Airport soon, and I could see it going there. It's a wall about the same size. It's a 60-foot wall. And I think I would do the same thing again, you know. I would recreate this kind of helix shape. But I think to keep it exciting for myself, I'd probably add more objects. This was more difficult because it won't be the same, you know.
How do you organize your studio?
That's a good question. I don't really. Sort of. I have one floor. I have a two-floor studio. They're both equal size. They're about from here to the end. And one floor has only human-made objects on it. And the top floor has kind of in Tupperwares in varying sizes all the materials I've gathered up from nature. And they're organized pretty well because they have to be. And it's weird, but, you know, the way I make art is geared by temperature in a way. Like, the bottom part of my studio is miserable in the winter, so I just sort of go upstairs and make art up there. And then when it gets a little bit warmer, I go downstairs, it's nice and cool, and I make work there. Most of the things that I make are very large and very kind of impractical in ways. Scale's a big thing for me. You know, I like to make things bigger than me. I think when you make things larger than you, I mean, not only is it challenging, but it has a power to it that makes you be small. And I would rather the work be big and me be small. And I would also say, you know, a typical show that I have, there would be maybe 9 very large sculptures and maybe 3 or 4 like this big. And I love to make things small too, and but it's got to be the right kind of robust materials to pull it off at a small scale.
And how do you get your pods through customs?
Is that a trick question?
No.
Well, I'll tell you what I do on the good side is that when I, the rules of import are no live materials, no fruit, no seeds. So when I collect, I completely clean them, I take the seeds and fruit out, so they become legal. And then I ship them home with my stuff. I mean, understand that it's, I'm 3 or 4 weeks in the jungle at the equator, and you know, there's a lot of material, other material in my baggage besides the pods. So I kind of just intersperse the pods in the bags and take them with me. And one thing I would say for all of you potential smugglers is I don't fit the profile. I have never been searched once, and I've, you know, been to Burma many times, to Madagascar, to probably the last 10 years or so I go to the Amazon a lot, a little bit more than that actually, because it's closer, and I've never been searched. I've done it, I've been sponsored through National Geographic to do a project. So I had diplomatic immunity. So in that case, I wasn't searched, and neither were my bags. However, they had to be shipped separate from me, and they got lost, and then they got found, and it took me months to get the material, to get the pods. So since that time, I don't do it through those channels any longer. It's just better if I bring them home. It's always exciting, and it's like Christmas.
So are you only into still frame art, or you do motion art as well?
I'm sorry, what?
Are you only into still frame art, or do you do motion art as well?
I don't really know what you mean, motion art.
And you know how you have some people that project art in different forms, some motion picture, you know? Not really.
You know, there's a video in this room, but that's about as close as I get to motion. And you know, this video follows me around collecting in Guyana. It's 7 minutes long, and it's good. You know, I mean, I think it captures what I do. It's sort of like an elongated day in my life, so to speak, when I'm there. And you know, it's a lot of fun.
Do you work for other artists? I mean,
Nah, I don't really collaborate.
Okay.
I have a lot of people who work for me. And it really is, that part of it is a collaboration. And the idea of appropriation and other people doing things for me is something I really like also. And I think everybody gets something out of it. You know, the actual, like I said earlier, the actual manufacturing of the things isn't that important to me. The end product, the end game is what matters. So, you know, in the films that I make, I collaborate because I'm a bad filmmaker and I hate editing. So, you know, I'm really all about use your strengths, know yourself, know what you're good at and know what you're not good at. And I know what I'm not good at. You know, like in my studio, because I'm like ADD, I probably work on 10 sculptures at the same time. You know, and I'll like work on one large sculpture and I'll kind of burn out on it, run out of gas, run out of ideas, move to something else. And in my mind, you know, I have little pockets. That's that sculpture, and I keep them very separate. You know, I try to, on each sculpture, deal with different issues, different materials, you know, a different paradigm, and that's very helpful too. I don't like crossbreeding, you know. I really don't like to go to shows where it's about a series of work that there's hardly any difference between one to the next. Not that that's bad, it's just not for me. So I like to work on lots of things at the same time, knowing that whatever, you know, in 1 year I have to come up with X amount of sculptures. So.
So did you do artwork for other people, like say they wanted some art done for some projects or whatever for themselves? Do you do work for other people as well, or just mainly for yourself?
No, I can only control me. You know, I really am one that, you know, right or wrong, I'm saying what I want to say, and to me that's art. You know, although there's lots of ways to do it, but this is the way I prefer to do it. I mean, in my life, there's only one thing I'm truly in control of, and it's my art. You know, when you have friends or family, it's all compromise. It's all give and take, you know. But not at this. This is no give and take. This is the only thing that I call the shots on, for better or worse. You know, I live by, if I did my job right, it's going to be a good piece. If I didn't, I try not to show it. But, you know.
Ron, can you say anything about your interest in sports and your use of, you know, other Americana iconography, images like that, and objects like that in seemingly really other artworks?
Well, you know, I'm always looking for personal icons or personal images that relate to the culture. And it's a very organic, natural process. The things that I'm interested in life, I think, you know, you guys might be interested in them, you may not, but I'm, you know, like I said earlier, I'm you, just a different version. And as an artist, I think it's really one of the most enjoyable things is to try to speak for something bigger than you. And so every object out there, and here is something that I just selected because I think it's got something to do with our culture, something to do with me, mostly. You know, about the sports thing, you know, I really love sports. You know, I got a kid who's like a baseball nut. So, you know, that stuff's around in my house and in my studio. So those things just come up. And you know, if it's too trite or too kind of stupid, I try to stay away from it. But if I think it has resonance, you know, I try to dig deep into it and look for things that have resonance to me that describe our situation. You know, it's kind of, every once in a while I think, you know, we look at art history and art history tells us about a moment in time. And if I could jump out of my moment in time and think, you know, whatever, 50, 100 years from now, somebody looks at this, they're going to know what was going on in this person's life at this moment in time. And I think just being honest about it, for better or worse, is what I'm interested in. And I think when I am honest about it and just lay it out there, you know, it can have resonance, you know. So, you know, yeah, kind of. Were you going to say something? Well, well, I'll tell you, the on one of my very first trips to the equator and to the forest, I was laying on this giant lily pad, like as big as me, and you know, it had an amazing like cellular structure. I mean, it was incredible. I was just laying on my back, looking around, and it's always moist, it's always humid, and I was looking for a material that could kind of discuss that when I got back home, and it was, that's why I picked wax and encaustic initially, was because it added a sheen to it, it added a permanent kind of feeling of glaring translucency, made me feel like I could sort of recreate that moisture again. You know, in terms of color, in this piece, I'll tell you, I had the obvious choices, you know, because to me, you know, I could have picked like pink and blue, you know, that would be sort of, to me, in other words, instead of going with black and white on most of these pods, I could have picked pink representing female, and I could have picked blue representing male. You know, but I thought that would really spoil it. And I, for someone like me, I felt that would be a stupid choice. You know, be too obvious. And part of my idea in making art is to give the viewer intellectual leverage. You know, I'm not telling you what to think. I'm not painting a portrait of somebody. You know, I'm laying out information, and hopefully the viewer is going to bring to it a little bit of themselves. So I don't want to be too obvious. You know, I want to like give you and me enough to go on, but not too much. So the idea of stripping it down to black and white fundamentally was my solution to that. Just sort of neutralizing the colors or lack of color. So, and you know, in different sculptures, I mean, I use like lots of wax. Sometimes I really drip it a lot to give it texture. And that's why.
So you might take another with this and paint every cork of the bottle red, white, blue, green, and it would be a very colorful sculpture rather than this much more muted palette.
Right. And that's what I'm interested in, it being subtle, a little more quiet. You know, the corks is interesting because when I first got them, somebody gave me 1,524 corks, and it was an ex-student of mine, and he shipped me a box of them. And when I first got them, I was like, I don't know what to do with these things. And they sat for like 6 months or so. But I knew, I mean, this is part of our culture, corks, wine. And, you know, eventually figured out a way that I preferred to use them in this sculpture. So, I mean, a lot of stuff just evolves to me over time. A lot of things I don't have the answer to, like, initially. But I'm also very patient, and I think that over time I can figure things out. You know, a lot of artists, when they have an idea, make a drawing, and that's their method of investigation. That's their method to get to the end of what they would like to say. But in my situation, I try to never do that because it will spoil the whole adventure for me. If I try to draw things out, it's too much of a map for me, and I have a difficult time getting away from it. You know, that's just me. I'm not saying right or wrong. You know, when I was a kid, I liked to build forts, and I liked to, you know, do Lego, and I liked to build things. And I think that had a lot to do with, ultimately, how I decided to make art. You know, it was more a process of addition. It was more a process of get this, put this together, put that together, da-da-da-da-da. Eventually, I would figure out what it is I wanted to do. And so eventually, that created my aesthetic and the way I make art. And I could only think of drawing these things out ahead of time for me as being a hindrance. You know, a lot of times when I go to schools and talk, I try to keep a lid on that one because you're really trained in art school to draw your ideas. And I'm all about that too. However, for me, I think, you know, once you establish a database that's broad enough, you don't really need to draw things out. It's already drawn out in your mind. You know, like this sculpture was in my mind completely without drawing it out. And, you know, I think you can tell from the placement of objects that it's intuitive. You know, it's, although it, in the end, if it's working, it looks effortless, like anything, you know. Anything done well looks effortless. Anything athletic, anything, a book written, something designed. But along the way, it's not effortless. Along the way, it's a lot of effort, and it's a lot of mistakes. And, you know, I was talking to this guy over here earlier, Mitch, just about the beauty of mistakes and how important it is in making art to make mistakes. Because if you just follow what's already been done, you're just going to do what's already been done, and you're going to be boring. You know, it's not going to be interesting. So making mistakes is really important to me. And I go out of my way. I once had a teacher, a photography teacher, who's a very well-known guy, who said to me, when I do something so well and know it so well, I stop. Because then it just becomes a slick product. And that's nothing I'm interested in. I'm interested in that kind of terse exploration of trying to figure it out. And, you know, I feel much the same way. That's forever influenced me. When I get too good at something, too slick at it, I either stop or I try to trick myself, make mistakes, do it with my left hand, try to figure out a way so that it still is human. Because when things become too slick, they become mechanical, and you might as well have a machine make it. And I'm really about the human experience, about making mistakes. Most everything in here is imperfect in a way, and it's casually done on purpose. You know, if things are dripping or, you know, that's the way I like my aesthetic to be. So, you know, and part of the idea of making mistakes and understanding that, like, making art is experiential. It's totally experiential. You know, you can't will it. You know, you can't go, oh, I'm going to be a really good artist. It just doesn't work that way for me. You have to work hard at it and make the necessary mistakes daily, you know? Because from every mistake comes some success. I was in a show a few years ago called The Success of Failure, and they asked every artist to bring in one of their first pieces, whether it was painting or whatever, and something that they currently were making. And it was really great to see how bad everybody is in the beginning. Yeah, everybody's bad. Nobody starts out. It's like a musician. I mean, that's real. That's the more obvious thing. You start out learning how to play an instrument, and you're horrible until it becomes unconscious, until you don't have to think about it anymore. And to me, that's I try to lose my mind when I make art. You know, I try to not think and try to be unconscious, subconscious, but just not conscious. Because when I'm too conscious, it's too, it lacks a lot of spirit, lacks a lot of soul. So it's a lot of my methods or ways that I operate. I'm sorry, what?
Do you do tutorials and everything like that on the art that you do?
Tutorials?
Yeah, like say you had other people that wanted to kind of project art in a similar fashion as the way that you have projected art, and you send me to look for you as like a mentor or something like that. Mm-hmm. Contemporary art or modern art that they try to project and put into effect. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's nothing formal, but, you know, I do have, you know, a good number of people who visit, talk, you know, and I also, I'm not sure, but I think that when somebody works with me for a few years, it's osmosis, you know, I mean, they get my aesthetic, they get it, and I think they can kind of breathe it in a little bit, and it's never going to be the same, you know, like, if I say to you, make, it's not going to be the same as I make it. So I think it's a lot of what happens in art. It's just this osmosis where you look at something, you integrate it into your own system, and it never comes out as a ripoff, typically, unless you're just trying to rip somebody off. You know, I've had like several experiences. Like my last show in New York, I had several people like photographing my work, which often happens, and the guy who owns the gallery like said, what are you doing? And this one person said, I just want to rip him off. And I thought, oh, that's really okay with me, because you're only ripping off what I did 3 years ago, you know, and that's just not the way it works. You could rip it off, but integrate it through yourself, and it won't be the same. Or you're just, you know, a couple years behind. So, I mean, I think that all that stuff is okay, you know, especially with appropriation. I mean, I know, you know, a lot of people appropriate, a lot of people borrow and take stuff, and, you know, I think all of that is okay. I don't have any formal, like, you know, I teach, but I don't really teach what I do. You know, I don't feel like it's about me. It's about the students. And so I really try to help them develop their own aesthetic and keep it away from me, pretty much.
I have two more questions. Does anybody want to keep?
Yeah.
Technical questions, or actually about the materials. Mm-hmm. The large hooks that are coming out of the wall, are those found objects, or were those purchased somewhere?
The large, which ones?
The large ones that are holding up the circles, like the loops. They're rust, like a rusty metal.
Oh, you mean the hardware?
Yeah.
Yeah, those are purchased from Home Depot. Okay. You talking about these?
I like those hooks, yeah.
These hooks?
Yeah.
Really nice.
Yeah, and what do you know the kinds of trees or fruits the different pods are from? Mm-hmm. Can you tell me some of the names of them?
Yeah, this is from the water chestnut family, but they're from Asia. You know, I haven't seen, but I know around here, because you have so many lakes, you probably have water chestnuts that kind of grow right next to the banks. And the American water chestnuts are like about this big and very prickly. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe you notice them. And this is in the same family, but they're from Asia. And, you know, I drilled a hole through each one of them and strung them just like you would make a giant necklace.
It looks like vertebrae almost.
I hope so.
So, Ron, what in the transformation of your pieces, is it the materials that start to dictate the concept, or you came to it with that idea of the helix and then saw
yeah,
the materials kind of
that
through
way,
those
that
eyes?
Way. I wanted to make... You know, I wanted to make a helix. I have made, in other sculptures, small helixes. And I just love the shape and the idea, and I wanted, so that came first. You know, I wanted to make a big helix, and then, you know, I decided about material, what's going to look the best. And, you know, even though this, I think I'm very happy with this, you know, along the way, I tried maybe half a dozen different objects from nature, and they all were horrible, you know. So it's usually the idea comes first, and then the materials fill in the gaps.
The materials,
yeah.
Kind of as you go.
Yeah.
I want to know more of the pod names. if you have it, like the banana.
Well, these.
Ones.
Well, I just made those up. I call them banana pods.
I don't
really know what they are. But in the larger sculpture, or in the sculpture out there, there are larger, what are called monkey pods. Can you see them from where you are? They're the biggest thing sticking off the wall.
Okay.
That's what these are. Also,
okay,
here's what happens in my experience. Stuff that grows at the, that you can take the same tree, for example, you can get a mahogany tree, which has really great pods that drop off of it. And in the Amazon, they're like this big. In Central America, they're like this big. And in Florida, they're like this big. And it's the same with the monkey pods. These are from Central America. The ones there are from the Amazon. And, you know, on the equator, things are growing so fast. You know, I mean, you would get lost in a day because you may break a trail and have a nice path at 6 a.m. and by 6 p.m. it's, where is it? So things grow very rapidly. It's very robust.
How do the locals react to you gathering all this stuff? Like, do they help you? And they're like, who
they
are
do.
You? What are you doing?
Always a great experience. Very helpful. And one of the funniest things is I try to go back to the same place a few times because it's very difficult to not only find a place but find guides. And this one place I go to, the last time I went there, I don't have the trash man's back to clean up the floor of the jungle, you know? And that's how they relate. So when I get there, I'll have a guide, and we'll get, like, mosquito net and hammocks, some stuff to protect us from the rain, and just pretty much live off the land, bring, like, grains, but, you know, there's fruit everywhere, stuff like that. And just go into the forest for 3 weeks to a month and just start getting at it. And, you know, and in a lot of cases, I can't identify the names of the trees because they're indigenous names and I don't know what they are. But my criteria is really aesthetic. You know, it's like, this looks great. I want it. And that's pretty much... so anyways, you know, when you go out or something, you see that piece of monkey pods are amazing. You know, they're like beautiful pottery to me, beautiful vessels. And the way they grow on the trees is there is a vine that comes off the branch, and then there's a cap on top of the pod. So you pull the cap off. In that case, and in these cases, those are monkey pods. They're named that because the monkeys eat a fruit that looks like blackberries out of it. So they'll pull the cap off, they'll dig in, grab the fruit, throw it in their mouth, and then they'll throw the pods down on the ground, you know, at you if you're there, or just on the ground. And, you know, for those that don't really know much about primates, monkeys, for example, some of them are so smart. They're really smart. And they'll mock you. They'll see who you are and they'll screw with you. You know, just like, you know, they'll look at you like they might, for example, you know, see someone who has a shaved head or someone who has long hair and the shaved head, they go, you know, like just kind of make fun of you. And, you know, that's something... I mean, you know, it's really off topic, but that's something I really enjoy about going there is like following a troop of monkeys around for a day, seeing how they hang, seeing what they do. And typically the indigenous people are super helpful. you know. When I go, I usually bring pictures and show them what it ends up like in the end, and they're like, wow, you know. You know, I'm going to do that too, you know. So, yeah.
Did you spend a lot of time adjusting the lighting in here to get the effect of the shadows?
These guys did.
It seems like that adds so much to the piece.
Yes, absolutely. You know, and if they didn't do it, I would have to. But, yeah, the shadows are big. You know, the whole relationship of the objects to the wall is what makes it. I mean, if they don't float off the wall, if they're just stuck on the wall, then it's going to be boring to me. You know, I really want there to be a relationship between the objects to the wall, the shadows to the objects, etc., you know. In fact, you know, when they turn on the fluorescent lights, it ruins the, it ruins it, for me at least. You know, as I said earlier, I'm a sculptor, I'm really a 3D kind of person, and so the shadows and getting this thing to be like a roller coaster off the wall was important to me. It's got a lot of texture, you know. Most times when I have shows, people touch, you know, and I really like that idea. You know, typically, they usually touch when somebody's not looking, but, you know, so long as no one is trying to destroy it, I really enjoy that because I feel the same way. They're very tactile. You know, I want to touch them, and if I want to, you know, I hope I'm doing it well enough so that you want to kind of, what is that, you know? Like, some of my best compliments from viewers are, you know, I've stepped in that hundreds of times and never noticed it, you know? And I really like that, you know? And I think once somebody says that, from that point on in their life, they're going to look a little bit closer at things. And, you know, a lot of the subtext of my work has to do with ecology, recycling, you know, using what's already there, and trying to lay off new pollution.
So what's some of your artists that you like kind of inspired by now?
Well, I like the life of Paul Gauguin a lot. His life was a big inspiration to me in terms of the freedom that he tried to have and, you know, just him as a person. I really liked that part of him. I like Eva Hesse a lot. Joseph Beuys. You know, I appreciate the appropriated artist who came before me, who opened up the doors to appropriate, you know, like Duchamp. I'm trying to think, have you ever seen Luncheon in Fur? Have you seen those ceramic cups with the fur inside?
Meredith.
Huh? Yeah, there we go. I couldn't remember her name, but I loved her work because, I don't know if you guys know it, but, you know, it's from the 30s or so, and she was hanging out with all these kind of surrealist and found object people, and she would take a ceramic cup and line it in fur. And that was a big influence to me, the juxtaposition of materials. Because if you look at my work, especially that piece out there, which is more typical of what I do, it's always going to be hard object with something really soft, natural object with something from industry. And it's that juxtaposition, that relationship, that I really like a lot. And so, you know.
If you had to make a pick out of all of them, who would be like in number one?
Number one? I don't know. I have to think about that. I really don't know. I'll tell you, you know, I don't think about that too much. In hindsight, I think about it a little bit, but I don't really think about that much. You know, I do have artists who I really like, painters, contemporary painters who I really like. You know, there's other sculptors whose work I really like a lot. But I wouldn't say really influences me, like Merritt Oppenheim with the Luncheon and Fur that I discussed, or Boyce, you know, I love his, like, he would just lay down a hunk of wax. I really like that a lot. Yeah, I think the nice thing about art history is that they have solved a lot of problems for us. All these people who preceded us, artists, like, you don't have to do it. They already did it for us, you know, and to copy them seems ridiculous and redundant, but to use their information seems to me like a smart thing to do. I mean, they have explored, you know, and left a body of data and a body of information, visual information, for me to look at and go, yeah, I really like the way he handled this idea or that, you know. And I would expect it would be the same for anybody, you know, like, you know, if anybody came and looked at this, oh, I like the way he did that. Yeah, I'm going to take off on that and fly. I love that idea, you know, up it, make it better. You know, every generation should be better and better. You know, every group should learn from history and not repeat it, but outdo it, you know. So that's kind of my attitude about it.
Any last questions?
I have a gallery up in New York, Howard Scott Gallery. It's on I think 21st in Chelsea. And, you know, he handles a lot of painters mostly. And it's interesting because, I mean, I'm the only sculptor in the at his gallery, but the painters that he handles sort of paint like I make sculpture. You know, they're very, you'll see, repetitive, you know. Repetition's a big thing in my work, as you can tell, you know. Establishing repetition is what makes it work. You know, as you look through this, you can see the vacuum belts, you know. Whatever you may see, you need to see it repeated, or there's too much chaos, you know. And that's a fine line that I walk, the, you know, chaos and order. That's
cool.
Yeah. Okay, anything
else? Thank you,
guys.